House Elections, Ethics, and Rules Committee. Happy President's Day, everybody. We have two very engaging bills to hear today, and we are going to start right in, open the public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2589. This will be a public hearing. We're not planning to work this bill today. There is committee members in your packet from Mr. Stembridge, a staff measure summary on this bill that I will direct you to. Prohibits members of the Legislative Assembly from using their positions as former legislators to obtain financial gain through lobbying until adjournment sine die of the legislative session following their terms of office. And that is the bill that we will be hearing. I see that we have been joined by Representative David Edwards. And Representative Edwards, would you like to come forward and tell us your thoughts on this bill? We're on House Bill 2589. Good morning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Representative David Edwards. I represent Greater Hillsboro, North Plains, Roy, and Revolt. I appreciate the opportunity to speak before the committee. Influence from the right people often drives what happens in Capitol buildings across the country, and the most direct way to gaining that influence needs to be shut. The door that needs to be shut is the revolving door that allows former state legislators to become lobbyists, consultants, and strategists as they exit the door at the end of their legislative careers. This influence involves the privileges they gained as a member and the power and the access they have to their former colleagues. This bill is necessary to increase the public's confidence in its representative government. There's ample evidence that suggests that the revolving door often creates at least the appearance of serious conflict of interest. Good government groups from around the country have advocated for the shutting of these doors. Oregon needs to close this revolving door as well. This bill prevents former members from lobbying the state legislature for one full session after their terms expire. The session is the critical time when lobbyists are called upon to open the right doors, make the right arguments, and push their clients' interests to the front of the line. This bill emphasizes the need to sit out an entire session. This approach is certainly directed at the most important time for influence, the session itself. In this respect, it is stronger than other proposed legislation being considered this year. It also adopts what other groups are trying to do at the federal level, which is to extend federal law to require former members to sit out a full session after they leave office. When a citizen runs for office and represents his or her district, the person is elected to represent the public. Indeed, elected officials are forbidden from using their office for private financial gain while in office under current law. This bill extends that pledge for an additional cooling-off period after they leave office. Oregon already has revolving door limitations for the state treasurer, insurance commissioner, and other officials in key regulatory departments. I think we need to extend these to state legislators as well. The public deserves to have this level of confidence in its government that these protections provide. And I urge an aye vote on this measure.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Representative Edwards, for the testimony. And I can agree with you that appearances are important. And I'm wondering if you would agree also that perhaps it should apply to state-appointed positions as well. And, you know, it appears that when legislators leave their term, either in the middle of their term or the end of the term, and then they're appointed by the governor, it just has a bad appearance. I'm wondering if you would consider adding something like that to the bill.
I think for the purposes of increasing the public's confidence, that it's not necessary to apply this provision to appointed positions. I believe that it's in the public's best interest that the governor have the ability to appoint the people that can best complete the tasks at hand, and that extending this provision to legislators who may be appointed to key regulatory positions would unduly constrain the governor's choices. Is that responsive?
And I would just point out there are certain appointed positions, like the Public Utility Commission, that are already covered. So,
okay.
Representative Baskerville.
Yeah, I think Representative Thatcher brings up a very good point, because We're talking about perception here because no one's really brought forth a real problem. You haven't identified a real problem other than perception, which I perception is reality in the eyes of the public. But I would think that we would maybe want to pursue what Representative Thatcher was talking about, because what's the difference between that and the thing that really irritates people in Southern Oregon is an individual that retires and gets back at full pay for a six-month period. They call it double dipping. What's the difference?
Well, in a sense, it's not necessarily comparable to double dipping, however, which is where...
Well, but it's the same perception of the public, is what I'm saying. If we're talking, we're dealing perceptions here, then we should deal perceptions.
But in this case, it wouldn't be someone who's retired who is then appointed to a position. They're essentially, you know, selected by the governor for a different job altogether.
Mm-hmm.
I fail to see how that's, you know, a voluntary violation of the public's trust.
Madam Chair, follow up.
Follow up?
No, if I retire, I hope it's because I want to retire, not
right.
Because the voters have voted me out.
That's perception.
We hope that too. Other questions for Representative Edwards? If not, thank you very much for being here this morning.
Thank you.
We have several other people signed up to testify, and we'll start with Kathy Eaton. Would you like to come forward?
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kappa Eaton. I'm the governance coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. The League of Women Voters is, I think most of you know by this time, is a grassroots, political, non-political organization which encourages informed public participation in government. Thank you very much for the opportunity to comment on HB 2589, which adds members of the legislature to the statute prohibiting specified public officials from exercising undue influence or receiving financial gain through employment as a lobbyist for a certain time after leaving office. The League of Women Voters believes that this kind of ban on the so-called revolving door is important, particularly to alleviating the public perception of legislative misconduct. The League monitored the meetings of the Oregon Law Commission's year-long study of ethics issues, and we commend the recommendations forwarded to the legislature. Because Oregonians want responsible, responsive, and open state government, we believe the public's distress and frustration might better be served by a broader proposal, such as the prohibitions addressed in House Bill 2594, which I believe you're scheduled to hear next week in a sort of an omnibus hearing on the ethics proposals. That measure includes all public officials and candidates in a larger net of concern for possible economic benefit and special interest influence. We support the time limits in both the bills. This session of the legislature has an opportunity to act positively about the public's and the members of legislatures concerned over ethics issues. The League urges you to seriously consider closing the revolving door with a strong message to citizens. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for this witness? Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. I guess I would have the same question as I had for the last witness.
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Thatcher. That's an issue that we haven't discussed in any depth yet, and before we would make a comment, we need to talk about it within the Action Committee of the League. It certainly is an issue, but we haven't reached a consensus on it yet.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah. Looks like no other questions. Oh, I have one. Sorry. Vice Chair Berger.
Thank you. Mrs. Eaton.
Yeah, I was going to ask.
Other than the perception of the legislative revolving door, do you have any evidence of actual influence peddling that is in any way illegal or... other than the perception, the public perception that the revolving door leads to influence peddling, for financial gain. Do you have any evidence that it actually happens?
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Berger, I'm not sure exactly what you mean by hard. You didn't use the word hard, but about evidence. We're a public organization that talks a lot with citizens and works with citizens. And I'm sure that we could, as other organizations have done in the past, have put together information and data which shows influence of outside interests through legislators and the votes that come before this body. Oregon Action, in 2003 put together a very interesting book on that kind of action, where more than the perception was that votes in this body were actually influenced by people who were now working for special interest groups.
Madam Chair, I believe that's called lobbying, and I believe that you are registered as a lobbyist, are you not?
The league is registered as a lobbyist, yes.
And I guess what bothers me a lot about this is that when we quietly say, yeah, this is a good idea, we then sort of are implicitly saying that legislators who come back after serving and then come back as a lobbyist are therefore corrupt or corrupting. And I have not in my three terms seen any evidence that legislators that come back as lobbyists have any more influence than any other lobbyists within this building. And I'm not ready to sit here. I mean, there's a public perception problem that I'm willing to concede, that the public's, because they don't understand this process as well as you do, and they don't understand lobbying as well as you do, and the sort of all lobbying is corruption sort of mindset that we live in. But I have yet, what we're basically saying here, if we just quietly say, oh, okay, good idea, is that lobbyists are corrupt, and that people who lobby and come back as, you know, who leave as legislators and come back as lobbyists are corrupting. And I just have yet to see any evidence of that, and I'm a little disturbed that we leave this impression that because there's a perception, we agree with it, despite the fact that there's no evidence. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, I think that I don't believe that there is a perception that all lobbyists are evil. However, I believe that the time frame for when public officials come back as lobbyists needs to be extended. I think that the perception is that if you really almost you finish your term and then you almost immediately come back as a lobbyist, that there is a connection there, whether there is or not. And so that's the reason that we are supporting a time difference between the time that a public official leaves office and the time when they come back as a lobbyist. That's the issue, I believe, that's here.
One more question. Follow-up? In other words, from your testimony that you gave, the statement you just made, it is a perception problem.
Yes, and I think it's a... Thank you.
That is the point I'm
making. Yes, it is a perception problem. And that's something that you need to deal with and how you decide how to deal with the revolving door, because the public perception is very strong, good or bad.
Representative Roblin.
And I guess that what I would say is I don't have as much of a problem with the perceptions that you were just talking about, but the perception that sometimes I see that people have talked to me about is that during this session, for example, I choose to vote a particular way, and then one of those votes that I took ends up in me getting a job later with a big company as their lobbyist. That perception is one that's difficult to fight, and I think, you know, knowing the people that I work with, I feel very comfortable. It had nothing to do, the connection was not there, but the perception from people is that you're going to get this job because you act a particular way during the session you're in. that one is a perception that I think is out there amongst a lot of people that I talk to, and I don't know if that's something you guys have talked about as well.
Yes, Representative Rubin. Yes, that's exactly what we're talking about. But somehow that has to be dealt with. How you do that, you're going to have to make a decision about. We're simply agreeing with the idea that what you do, particularly during the session, is going to make a difference, because unfortunately there's a lot of distress and distrust and frustration among the folks out there. And so we believe that it's very important that you discuss it as you are, and that you come to some resolution as good a one as you can.
Vice Chair Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Seaton, thank you for your testimony. Would you say that both on the federal level and the state level, it blends together kind of in the public's mind? We have the congressman who helped move through the Medicare D program, who then immediately resigned and took a rather well-paying job with a pharmaceutical company. And here in the Oregon House, we had a former speaker who actually, while still speaker, signed a contract to become a lobbyist. So do you see this as kind of overlapping federal, state, and even local, that the perception problem kind of goes all the way through?
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Buckley, I think it's been exacerbated by the fact that we hear constantly about what the problems are with Congress and how they're acting. K Street, for instance, a lot of people are concerned about what happens in K Street and how those lobbyists work to influence legislation in Congress. And certainly it overflows. That's one of the problems.
Representative Pence.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned House Bill 2594, another bill in this area. As I'm reading those two bills in the staff measure summary, it looks like 2594 has an exemption for current members of the legislature, whereas this bill would include and apply to current members of the legislature. What's your take on where we should end up on that?
Representative Hunt, that's exactly one of the issues, and I think one of the reasons you have 2589 before you, as I understand it, is because it would apply to current legislators. The League would support involving current legislators with this legislation, yes.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Next, we'll hear from Janice Thompson. Good morning.
Janice Thompson with the Money and Politics Research Action Project, a nonprofit focused on government accountability and opportunities. I am testifying in support of this legislation that would just echo some of Ms. Eaton's comments and just suggest, you know, also taking a look at House Bill 2594, the Law Commission bill. I was actually part of the advisory group that kind of tracked that process. And in addition to the difference that Representative Hunt made, it also just covers a few things. So there are some important pieces of that, even if you go with this particular approach, that shouldn't be lost out of that particular bill. The chart I've distributed, we first put together back in 2003 when this issue popped up quite a bit. In response to the events that Representative Buckley referred to regarding former Speaker Mark Simmons, while still in the legislature, taking a public affairs position and subsequently lobbying in the following session. So there was kind of a flare-up then. This was ours. You know, this was put together by, you know, taking a look at talking with folks and taking a look at, you know, legislators and the lobbying lists. It's not an exact, you know, if somebody else sees somebody missing, just let me know. it's not like there's this one place you can go, so it's just cross-referencing. I also make a note that towards the end, In terms of updating, I have not had a chance to take a look at either the 2005 or the current 2007 list of lobbyists in terms of potentially some other former legislators who waited longer. So just those are the caveats about this. But it does give some indication of, I think, two things. One is there are definitely folks who are already, for whatever reason, kind of operating, coming back after a cooling off period. So one dynamic there is just to recognize that that works for some people. The flip side of that is that there are a number of folks, 19, who did return, indicating that the revolving door does exist. There's been mention of, you know, these dynamics at the federal level. I think in the public's eye, a lot of this does get pulled together. And I think Representative Roblin really hit on probably the most critical concern about this, which is not so much that they're coming back as a lobbyist. And I would really share Representative Berger's concerns that this not be perceived as vilifying lobbying. I think that's a big problem. I think public service and legislative service should be much more highly regarded than it sometimes is, just as lobbying should be more highly regarded. But I think the issue that Representative Roblin made, where it's like, oh, did that person get a job because of something previously, is where, you know, imposing a cooling off period seems like a reasonable balance and an approach to take. And it should be recognized, I just checked National Conference of State Legislators, Oregon would join 28 states with similar rules. And it does seem like there's also a fairness issue if these rules are going to be applied to a number of state agency heads to kind of, you know, turn around as fair play. And would also, it probably was in Capital Clips, but just there was a February 14th article, you know, indicating that one of the legislators who is returning does feel like there's issues of public trust and would, you know, have complied with these rules if they had been put in place. So urge your adoption of this bill as well as consideration of other pieces of 2594.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum. I saw this chart here, and it lists individuals who served in the legislature and when their service ended in the legislature and then when they registered as a lobbyist. Now, were these all paid positions? Paid lobbyists?
I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I mean, the lobbying files don't distinguish in that regard.
Okay.
Looking at them, I think so, but other folks with more legislative history would probably be a better sense of that, but that's not a distinction that pops up when you review the lobbying files kept by the GSPC.
Okay, thank you. I do have one follow-up or maybe a comment. This bill doesn't address specifically legislators returning as lobbyists to the legislature in Oregon. Why? I could be hired as a lobbyist in Washington or Washington, D.C., for that matter, or Idaho or somewhere else. It seems like you might want to have that ability to not say all lobbying activities are off the table for you. I mean, it just seems like you'd want to address specifically legislators returning to the legislature in Oregon.
Hmm. You know, I would have to check the statute, but the language of the bill says a lobbyist as defined in ORS 171.725, which I think is Oregon. The statute that is specific to lobbying in Oregon. Certainly wasn't the intent of the bill to prohibit lobbying elsewhere. And I don't think it does that.
You can
pull it out.
Okay. Was that it? Mr. Berger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. May I again engage?
Mm-hmm.
Janice and I worked quite a bit together in the Oregon Law Commission work group. Janice, this is about perception, is it not? We have no evidence that influence 2 years later is any significantly different other than the perception of 1 year later after service. I guess I'm trying to confirm for you that we heard no such evidence in the Law Commission, and if some exists, I'd like to see it.
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Berger, I would concur that during the law commission discussions, nobody came up with some, you know, smoking guns here. It is a situation where there may be smoke, but no fire. Smoke, however, does obscure public trust.
And I can, thank you, Madam Chair, if I could comment. I concur that point, but I do not want to leave this hearing room without making it perfectly clear that this is a list that you've handed us of some pretty distinguished people who have come back, lobbied successfully within this body, and I guess we kind of imply that they're all up to no good by sort of letting this perception go unchallenged.
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Berger, the intent with putting together this list was not to make any of those kinds of aspersions, but rather just to map out and try to present some facts in terms of just the prevalence of this practice.
Thank you.
And I would also point out that if you look at this list, a number of these people would be able to do exactly what they did under the language of this bill. It's not an absolute prohibition. It's just saying we need to wait until the next legislative session, next regular session is over. And it looks like Mr. Buckley has done a little research.
Representative Thatcher is correct. The statute does not specify the Oregon legislature. It simply says influencing legislative action, which could mean on any level. So I think that's a valid point.
And I think we will be hearing from a couple of other witnesses who might shed some light on this, too. Okay. Other questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. And next we'll hear from Wendy Johnson. Looks like she has her statute in front of her.
Good morning, members of the committee. Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director of the Oregon Law Commission. My testimony today is more just sort of neutral, just wanting to provide some information. A lot today has already been mentioned about House Bill 2594, which is the Law Commission's recommended bill. And that bill is regarding subsequent employment. It's kind of how we categorize this general topic, is regulating employment of public officials after they leave public office. And so this area of the revolving door for legislators is just one piece of the Law Commission's recommended bill. So we do have a recommendation regarding revolving door in our bill that has been recommended to the Assembly. And I just want to remind those of you who aren't particularly familiar with the Law Commission is that's our only job is to recommend law reform to this body. And it's up to you to make those policy choices, so that's why my testimony is neutral. But I do want to testify on the differences between House Bill 2594 and the bill before you today, because even though the bill before you today is a very narrow bill that only deals with revolving door for legislators, it still is quite different from the Law Commission's recommended bill that has to do with this piece. First off, if you look at page 2 of the bill, sub 6, little a, the standard that is provided for determining whether somebody is going from the legislature to being a lobbyist and what is prohibited is really kind of tough language to try to walk through. I just want to read it to you. It says that a member of the assembly may not use or attempt to use the person's position as a former member of the legislative assembly to obtain financial gain as a lobbyist. That looks pretty okay, but if you start parsing it as a lawyer, you look at it and go, okay, so I've got to show that they used their prior position to get financial gain. The point is that you could say that you got the position for other reasons, or you have interests, or you have specialties or something. The language in this particular bill is just not an outright prohibition. It's got a standard that you've got to jump through that I think... with all due respect, the House Bill 2594 language is a little more direct. So if your goal is just to outright prohibit a revolving door for a specified time frame, you might look at the language in House Bill 2594, which just states a member of the Legislative Assembly may not receive money or any other consideration for lobbying. It's just direct. That's the constitutional issue involved with the revolving door kind of ban is free speech. You don't want to ban speech before the Legislative Assembly. And so the Law Commission's focus was trying to focus on the harm, which is compensation, getting paid to do that type of work. And so that's how come both bills are trying to deal with that just so happens the language in 2589 uses financial gain, and this attempt to use or whatever kind of language, the language in 2594 just prohibits receiving money or compensation. So I point out that difference. A second difference would be right underneath that sub 6 little b of the bill, starting on line 35. That is the exception that, if you look at 171.725, that defines public officials as those who work for an agency. So that is the bill is a revolving door ban for going into private lobbying, but not for lobbying for the public, for the state. So that is the difference between the Law Commission's recommended bill. We did not carve out a public exception. And finally, in Section 2, the last difference between the Law Commission's recommendation on this point, Section 2 of House Bill 2589 says the effective date is that it applies to any member who ceases to be a member on or after January 1st, 2008, which is the effective date for most legislation unless there's an emergency clause. That means that a legislative member, Senate or House, who is in the middle of their term, that this new law would apply to them. The Law Commission chose not to change the rules on people who had already ran for office, but to have the effective date be after, if you were elected or appointed after the effective date, so that because subsequent employment is about the perception, but there's also the ability to get a job after, and what you plan to do when you took a job. And so if you're a public official, you signed up to do something, changing the rules, the Law Commission didn't see as particularly fair, but didn't discuss it in great deal, I have to admit. So, but that is the difference between the two bills. So those are the three differences. Back to the premise of what I started out with, the 2594, the Law Commission's bill is a little more comprehensive in addressing subsequent employment issues of all public officials. There is the public perception, obviously, that you've heard from other witnesses this morning, but the focus is that you don't want influence to be done. I think, as Representative Roblin pointed out, you don't want an undue influence while a public official is in office so that they're currying favor for that subsequent job. And that's what most subsequent employment laws are focused on, is that harm. It's not the later harm, because then you have the same kind of speech issues and such, and we want experts, so we want lobbyists with great expertise, but we're trying to curb behavior while you're a public official. And so this type of legislation will helps affect that. But, it is a mixture of issues that you're trying to combat. It's public opinion, the smoke, if you will, and it's also that influencing while in office. But that's all I have to point out for information. And as I think a previous speaker noted, House Bill 2594 is scheduled for a hearing on the 28th of February.
And just to clarify, I assume that you or the Law Commission would not oppose a bill where legislators chose to impose this on themselves.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, the Law Commission hasn't even reviewed House Bill 2589, and that's why I'm neutral on the bill on behalf of the Law Commission. I'm here to point out the differences between the bills and the policy choices, but we have no position on the bill itself. We just want to point out that our job was to recommend. We recommended something that looks a little different, and I just want to point out those differences.
And the point that Representative Thatcher was raising earlier, your bill would seem to have the same problem as this bill. The prohibition applying to lobbying, not just here in Oregon, but anywhere.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, my understanding is the definition of lobbying in Chapter 171 is that it only applies to lobbying this legislative assembly, and there's some language in there that suggests it also applies to the governor, but it has been interpreted by the GSPC to not clearly cover lobbying the executive branch, and so that's one of the things the Law Commission fixed, is that the definition of lobbying should apply to both. But my understanding is that it does not extend to D.C. or local governments or anything, that it is, Chapter 171 is a very narrow chapter. And then that same definition carries over into Chapter 244, the ethics.
So either bill should
be fine.
Be fine in that respect. Okay, are there questions? Representative Hunt.
Just on that, in 2594, there is a line that specifically says a public official, under Section 3, a public official may not attempt to represent or represent a client for a fee before the governing body of a public body, with the public officials and members. So that actually explicitly... And the other one does, I think, limit it to what Representative Thatcher was talking about. So maybe implicitly it's in both. It's maybe more explicitly in 2594, that one line.
Chair Rosenau, Representative Hunt, I believe you're talking about while you're a public official presently, not subsequent employment. The Law Commission's bill addresses both issues because you have some legislators and, frankly, representing clients while they're members of the Assembly, which has issues in and of itself, but we made it explicit that that's not permitted.
Okay. Other questions? Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. And next we'll hear from Ron Burson, who I think may be able to shed light on some of the things we've just been talking about. Not that light hasn't already been shed. Additional light, I should have said. Good morning.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Ron Burson. I'm the Executive Director for the Government Standards and Practices Commission. And again, I wanted to testify this morning as a neutral party, in favor or against this bill, but I did want to point out, and Wendy touched on it just a little bit, is the language that's in this bill is similar. Actually, I think it's exactly the same as what's in Senate Bill 10. And I testified earlier about the problems the GSBC would find in actually regulating this type of language because of the ambiguity on using the person's position as a former member of the legislature. And a lobbyist firm could hire a former member of the legislature for many reasons, and it would be very difficult, if not impossible, for the GSBC to enforce this bill or approve that a person was hired because they were a former member of the legislature. So I just really wanted to point that part out. That's the one difficulty that I see with the bill. That's all.
Okay, questions? Vice Chair Berger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you would prefer the language of the Law Commission bill?
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Berger, yes, I would prefer that language. Or language that's similar, if you look at Section 1, when it simply talks about a person
section,
that's a,
Section 1 of
your bill.
Okay.
When it talks about, it's very specific when it says, a public utility commissioner, director of the Department of Consumer Business Services, the administrator of the Department of Finance and Corporations, and so on. And anyway, it goes on to say shall not. And so it's very specific in shall not. And so if you have this position, you shall not. So if the intent of the committee is to stop the revolving door for a period of time, the language that's in 2594 would do that also. But I think it needs to be very specific, just me as the regulatory body to be able to come back and, if somebody is lobbying, to be able to have that ability to stop it.
Other questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 2589? Okay, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2589 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2082. Colleagues, we have heard this bill twice before, and we still have plenty of people who want to talk about it. So that's why it's posted again today. And let's begin with Kathy Eaton again. Come forward, please.
Again, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Kathy Eaton, Governance Coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. And the League of Women Voters is still a grassroots, nonpartisan political organization, which encourages informed citizen participation in government. And we thank you for this opportunity to address one of the critical issues facing the Oregon initiative process, and that is protection from fraud. House Bill 2082 would put in place important procedures dealing with the petition signature sheets themselves, and there are a lot of pieces in that bill about that.
The proposed amendments include requirements for registration of petition passers, an Attorney General's summary of the measure before circulation, a threshold signatures before granting a ballot title, and the maintenance of payroll records for paid petitioners, among several others that we support. These rules would give the Secretary of State much more control over the way in which signatures are gathered, which is needed. The League's position on direct democracy stems from its research study, initially done in 85-88, with revisions and updates in 1996 and 2001. We support the constitutional right of Oregon citizens to propose or revise statutes through the direct initiative process. Part of our position states that, quote, paid petitioners must be required to identify themselves as such personally and on signature sheets, unquote. The League also believes in the necessity of protecting the public's right to know and combating corruption political campaigns. House Bill 2082 will better ensure that citizens are protected from petition passers who are falsely filling out sheets and threatening the whole process. However, while we have received assurances that these new rules will not interfere with the rights of volunteer petitioners, we request that the committee discuss more seriously with the Secretary of State what consequences there might be for volunteer efforts. We also are concerned that the proposals not interfere with the actual signature gathering through the process. There are several initiative reforms which the League feels should be considered by this committee and which we outlined at your informational hearing on January the 31st. We look forward to further discussions on the Oregon initiative process, and we urge that you move House Bill 2082 forward with the caveats that we have put up before you today. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? I wanted to ask you your comment about volunteers. Are there specific concerns you have about?
Well, it's not clear whether all of the kinds of restrictions that are being placed on chief petitioners and others in this in 2082 apply also to volunteer efforts. There's a great deal that are of concern about paid petitioners that's addressed, but it's not quite clear whether all of these various prohibitions or requirements also involve volunteer efforts.
Well, and I think if you get a chance to look at the Dash 1 amendments, and
I have read them all, 61 pages.
Okay. Yeah. certainly some of these things do not apply to volunteers. The registration process.
Yes, we understand that. We want to make sure that in the support to move initiative reform forward, which is important, that there are unintended consequences for those of us who volunteer.
Okay, we will definitely take a look at that. Thank you very much for
being
here. Next, we'll hear from Janice Thompson.
This is the dog and pony show this morning, Janice.
Welcome back.
Hi. Janice Thompson, the Mining Politics Research Action Project, speaking in favor of the Dash 1 amendments with a particular focus, as you might imagine, as a group that tracks political money, with the sections that impose the more frequent electronic reporting requirements on the chief petitioner activities related to initiatives, referrals, and referendums. That's a very important, I think, addition to the great leaps that Oregon has recently made in terms of C&E disclosure and applying it to this category. It makes a lot of sense, and it's an important piece of the bill. It's of particular interest to my organization, and wanted to just make sure that little pearl of wisdom in here was recognized and moved forward.
Okay, any questions? Thank you. And next we'll hear from Dan Fakley. Good morning.
I'm not going to read all this.
Good. Glad to hear it. That's a problem some committee members are also aware of.
It's true.
I want to, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I want to first...
Could you please identify yourself?
Oh, I'm Dan Fegley with the Ask Damascus Committee. I have not testified before a legislative committee in many years, so if I make some kind of a gaffe, it wasn't intentional there. I just wanted to testify on House Bill 2082, and after hearing a lot of the people, I'm sure that there's a lot of people here a lot more qualified than I am on this subject, but I am currently running a petition in the city of Damascus, and we're a small committee, and literally this box is campaign central. We run out of shoe boxes and milk boxes, and they just happen to fit our file folders. It's important that a small campaign be nimble. And what I wanted to get across is, so far, to get where we've gone, we've had to set up a PAC, and this is someone that is not knowledgeable in this area. And in order to do that, we've had to open a nonprofit bank account, which isn't the easiest thing in the world to do, then register with the IRS, get a federal employment number, and this is all quite confusing and time-consuming for just the average citizen that wants to take part in their election process. Our particular campaign is small. It's grassroots, a door-to-door campaign. If any of you are familiar with Damascus, the doors are quite a ways apart. So it's a labor-intensive campaign. Now, while we were doing this, the city of Damascus contracted with a firm to get input of citizens, and they had coffee clutches and even barbecues to get people out. And this cost the taxpayer approximately $35,000. They claim that they've talked to almost 700 people. And they also claim that that's an exceptional effort in a town our size. Our effort, going door to door, we've engaged far more than 700 people. We've even got signatures from far more than 700 people. And the cost to the taxpayer has been zero. In our city, we know, literally, the blind man that can't fill out his address and stay within three lines, let alone one. We know the people that have Parkinson's, and they can't fill out their address. They have to have help. And we also know the widows that can't take care of their participation in the public process. We serve, as I've gone door to door, I found that we serve a real public interest here. And our city charter, like most throughout the city, the state that I've read, actually defer to state rules, and rather than making their own rules up for how they run initiative petitions. So we're really interested in what is happening here. As a small group, we aren't able to make large contributions to campaigns to ensure our ideas get heard in the legislature. Instead, we have to have sound ideas and work hard to get them on the ballot. The election is where debate can take place and issues are discussed. This is where a democracy airs its laundry. It would be a shame to say you are trying to improve democracy by limiting that debate. Inserting the state bureaucracy in the printing of our petitions would be crippling and needless cost to the taxpayer. Like I said, we have to remain nimble. We can't have the state bureaucracy involved in our campaign. Requiring 10,000 signatures to get a ballot title is an impossibility. I refer to Damascus, but if you have a grassroots campaign, that will stop it. This bill would bring an end to the milk carton campaigns. But what should be in this bill? Some controls are definitely needed, and the walls to protect the system should be constructed carefully, not haphazardly, so as to trip up those who are trying to participate. The system needs to be easily accessible to its citizens, not a barrier. Those citizens who are registered to vote should encounter few additional barriers. They should be given unlimited time for gathering required signatures and should be able to turn in signatures periodically to get the valid signature count from the Elections Division. This would cut down on the last-minute rush before elections. Where should the barriers be placed? The government has an obligation to protect the integrity of the elections, and the way to do this is the major barrier should be at voter registration. Citizens have a vested interest in election integrity. Therefore, only citizens should be registered to vote. Those that have lost their right to vote have lost their right to sign and carry petitions. I'm running just a small campaign, and I find it quite overwhelming at times. Collecting signatures isn't the easy job some portray. Money will always find ways to enact laws. Don't shut down these shoebox campaigns. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Vice Chair Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe after you can tell me where I can get a couple of those boxes. I wanted to draw your attention to a couple of things. One, it is currently the law that only citizens can register to vote. It's a felony for a non-citizen to register to vote. That is the law already. I have a question about in terms of the templates. We had a representative from the Elections Division in last Friday to clarify for us what their thought is in terms of the templates. They are thinking that it would actually be a service to be able to do the template and then provide it, and you could make copies of it. It would be yours. They would hopefully save the time and confusion over turning in a template, have it refused, turning in another template, have it refused, prior to being able to go out and gather signatures. They see it as a providing a tool for you. Would that change your mind in terms of...
Well, probably not too much. My understanding was they wanted to print the petitions and sequentially number them. That is an extreme burden.
And I would have to, if I could follow
up.
I would have to agree. And they did clarify that is not their intention to do that. They want to provide a template that works, that you can make copies of, and then the chief petitioner would be the one to number the petitions and to control that.
So that would address my main concerns
right here.
Right,
and there are amendments coming that will clarify that, too.
Pardon?
There are amendments on the way to the bill that will clarify that.
Oh, okay. That would help a lot.
I just wanted to ask you, the campaign that you're working on, is that a statewide initiative or is it a local measure?
This happens to be a city initiative.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that in our version that we're working off of, most of these changes we've been talking about specify that they apply to state initiative.
Oh.
I'm not sure some of the things you're concerned about would even apply to what you're working on.
Well, what I'm working on currently, they may not apply so much. But this group also works in their area with statewide initiatives, ones that they think they can get involved in. And in particular, the 10,000 signature requirement was an onerous one for us to be involved in any kind of statewide initiative effort. And that being that being grassroots and door-to-door, to go out and try and collect signatures for something that does not have a ballot title and then reprint with the ballot title and go out and try and recollect.
I just want to clarify a couple of things for you, though. That requirement is signatures that you're going to have to get anyway. It's not saying you have to get those signatures, then get a ballot title, and then start
right.
all over again. Those are part of the ultimate number that you need, and they would count toward those.
And that's fine. But when in our area, I've talked to a lot of these people, once they've signed an initiative, and a month goes by, then one comes up with a ballot title on it, they're very likely to sign again and not even know it. And this is kind of a problem. We've had a problem even in our area. We're carrying three initiatives. We have to be very careful to make sure someone doesn't inadvertently sign them twice. And that would really add to the confusion.
Questions? Other questions? No. Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you very much.
And next, let's hear from Robert Shannon.
Good luck with your campaign.
Yes. Good luck. Thanks.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Robert Shannon. I live in the area of Damascus, as Don here does. Well, I'm all new to this here. I just heard about it just recently, about this new restrictions on signature gathering, and it looks to me like every time we come up with a different petition, they have more rules and regulations on us. And this, the way this is written up, as far as I can, appears to me that it'd be just about impossible to get anybody to work it. You know, I've worked them over the years, and I never got paid for it. I'm not working any right now, but I don't know. This thing is way out of reason, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, as far as these rules they got here, the 10,000 signatures and that. I mean, that's a lot of signatures before you even get a. But maybe you folks know better than I do. But I'm really against this petition. Or, I mean, this House Bill 2082. Any questions?
Questions? Vice Chair Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Shannon, the proposal has been brought up to lengthen the time available to gather signatures, to perhaps give a full 2 years to gather signatures rather than have cut off. Do you have any particular point of view? Would that be positive or negative to expand the time?
Well, sometime, about 2 years, that's quite a while, but we shouldn't have any less than a year, I would think, anyway. Because I don't know what they have planned for the length of time to gather signatures, I don't say, but it's pretty tough to get people to gather signatures now, get volunteers, you know. I found that over the years. People are working and they just don't have the time, you know. I'm retired, I have the time to do some of this.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much.
Mm-hmm. Were there other questions?
No.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And next we'll hear from Cal Husbands. Good morning. Please identify yourself.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Committee. My name is Cal Husbands. I live in Wood Village. You've probably heard of that little town. As you know, it's a town of about 3,000. That's adults, kids, dogs, and cats. We had some situation up there where the mayor tried to initiate a gross sales tax without a vote of the people. When I heard about this action, I went to some of the meetings, listened to him, listened to what he had to say, and decided to become involved in it. I became the chief petitioner and had numerous other helpers and other petitioners who handed out not only blank petitions to their neighbors to get signed, but also we went door to door. And fortunately, we don't have it. The doors are a little closer together than they are in Damascus. But we did concentrate on, I made it very clear to them to get legal signatures. A vote was held in November, and this proposed tax measure that which they had brought in and got on the ballot went down 89% against 5% for, which really represents the state of Oregon putting down sales taxes. It's very important that the initiative and referendum law that was passed and signed, as you know, back in 1902, and has been since copied by other 49 states. Now, 1902 was a couple of years before my birth, but not many. This law has been working beautifully for 105 years and doesn't need to be changed by a bunch of different things which they've been brought forth. It's been pushed, I feel, by for special interest groups for their own financial gain and power struggles. This law has been designed and dedicated for the use of all sizes of groups, small, such as we are, as we were, and large. And some of the things of which I have seen in it, especially the liability of the chief petitioner, that was a real scary thing. The gathering of 10,000 signatures before a ballot title. When you're going out and getting signatures, as you know, you've been out and contacted people. They want to see what the ballot title is. What are they signing for? If you can't show them what they're signing for, if they're a knowledgeable person, and people nowadays have higher and higher education, they read. They don't just take the word of peace sign. They want to know what they're signing for. If it doesn't have a ballot title, they say, sorry, I don't want to sign that. Also, this the numbering of them and being at the responsibility of the chief petitioner, we have other things to do other than do accounting work on keeping track of the ballot numbers and so forth. I would appreciate it if you stopped this measure in committee. It's been working. We've had a good law for over 100 years. Keep it going. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for your testimony. Questions? Vice Chair Berger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Husbands, you're pretty knowledgeable on the ground, as they say. So, and clearly you read what's put in front of you for your signature, which I hope everybody does, but there's some evidence they don't. Tell me this. One of the provisions in this bill is that there be some signal or identifier that says this petitioner is volunteer and this one is paid. Would that make a difference to you as a signer, or do you think it should?
It wouldn't make any difference to me, but it does make a difference to other people.
And should it?
There's people who have very strong opinions about signature gatherers, whether they're volunteers or whether they're being paid.
Could I pursue? So do you think it's a good idea or a bad idea to identify them?
I think it would be a good idea to identify them. And then the people can make a knowledgeable decision which they, how they want to handle it themselves.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much for your time.
And next we'll hear from Jeremiah Baldwin. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeremiah Baumann. I'm an advocate with OSPIRG, the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group. I would like to note before I comment on this particular bill in front of us that OSPIRG strongly supports the focus of this legislature and this committee on ethics and reform issues. We support both lobbying reform measures and the revolving door reform measures, and we also support efforts to reduce and eliminate fraud in the ballot measure process for initiative, referendum, and recall. We see ballot initiative and referendum process as really a cornerstone of our democratic processes here in Oregon. We think that it's an incredibly important right. In fact, it's the highest implementation of the very definition of democracy, that the people have a right to govern themselves. That, I think, puts an incredibly high level of importance on the questions before this committee. How do we both reduce the fraud that corrupts that incredibly important process, but we have to make sure that we're doing so without unintentionally infringing upon the ability of Oregonians to use that process. This is not an easy balance to strike. Any measures to restrict fraud will tend toward measures that make it somewhat harder to collect signatures and somewhat harder to qualify measures. And in general, measures that will increase the difficulty that is involved in qualifying a measure for the ballot will tend to make it, to have a disproportionate influence on smaller, truly grassroots-based initiatives, as well as on volunteer signature gathering in certain situations. A well-moneyed paid petitioning operation will generally have an easier time complying with any restrictions or hurdles put in front of it. With that in mind, Osberg supports many of the provisions in this bill, and we are pleased to work with the committee to make sure that we can reduce fraud. And I will outline here some of our concerns with particular provisions that are in the bill and the amendments as currently drafted. I'd also just note as context, and it could be helpful for any questions the committee has, that we, Osberg, does work when we have worked on ballot measures with both paid signature gatherers and volunteer signature gatherers. We take pride in running effective, efficient, and I don't know, I'm not sure what the positive word is, but non-fraudulent campaigns. And so we are happy to help design policies that will encourage more of that and less of the sort of signature of gatherer for hire phenomenon that I think often does lead to some corruption. We particularly support the campaign finance measures contained in this bill. We think that ballot measures should abide by the same campaign financing rules that candidates abide by. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court has struck down any limits on contributions to ballot measure campaigns, so we can't go there anymore, but we certainly support the disclosure provisions contained here. We also believe that the record-keeping requirements are a good way of enforcing existing rules regarding paid signature gathering. And any effective operation that is paying people to participate in this process should be able to keep good records of how that's working and who's being paid for exactly what work. I will note that we should look at the bill very closely to make sure that the record-giving requirements aren't unduly burdensome for a smaller, more grassroots operation, but in general, this is a fair requirement. The following provisions are the ones we've got concerns with. First, prohibiting writing, altering, or obscuring personal information on the signature sheet. I believe this is a provision that could be amended to make it simpler and easier to comply with and to make sure that helpful writing on the sheet is allowed. I don't think that a written request from someone who's disabled is probably allowing enough freedom. The way that I look at this is signature gatherers and campaign operations can write clarifying information such as a voter's name or address simply to aid the Secretary of State in validating signatures. That's an important function, one that results in more people signing ballots and getting their signatures qualified, fewer people being disenfranchised when they think they've signed a ballot petition but have their signatures invalidated. I'll also note that this is one of the provisions that I see as having a disproportionate impact on volunteer operations. The reality is a paid signature gathering operation will have a relatively easy time improving training for their signature gatherers and having the oversight necessary to make sure none of this is happening. A volunteer operation where people are downloading forms from a website or passing forms door to door, you're just going to have more volunteer signature gatherers who don't realize they're not allowed to clarify their neighbor's handwritten name when it's slightly illegible and are unintentionally disqualifying their own signatures. The second provision we have some concerns about is the registration and identification for paid signature gatherers. I'll first note, I'm not a constitutional lawyer, so can't comment on this personally, but similar requirements for in other contexts have been struck down as unconstitutional restrictions on free speech. I know that, for example, towns in East Coast states often have registration identification requirements for any type of door-to-door canvassing, and these have been repeatedly struck down as unconstitutionally infringing on the right to free speech. My bigger concern, however, is that these provisions simply dampen public participation in signature-gathering campaigns. I think we often hear the horror stories in the media about paid signature gatherers, you know, people moving from state to state that are engaging in shady activities. But we see at Osberg signature gathering generally, including paid signature gathering, as a unique opportunity for young people and people who generally aren't participating in the political process to get experience in the political process. The reality is a lot of young people, and particularly low-income young people, don't have the time or resources or probably in some cases the civic interest in simply volunteering. But the opportunity to get paid to participate in politics brings untold numbers of young people into the political process for the first time. The bill, as I currently read it, doesn't have any guidance or restriction on how long it could take to be registered to receive an identification. In fact, it right now would require every potential signature gatherer to read and understand the law related to ballot measures. And the reality is, you know, we'll often see that, you know, the day college gets out, 25 college students show up in our office asking if they can join the effort. I think sending them all down to even read the 60 pages of these amendments would probably discourage some of them from wanting to be so engaged civically. And certainly having to wait to get an identification from the Secretary of State could simply discourage people who wanted to participate and only for the best reasons. The last provision that I'll just note concern about is the requirement to get 10% of the necessary signatures in order to obtain a ballot title. I'm certainly aware of the problems around ballot title shopping, and it's certainly true that in recent years the ballot title process has become a venue wherein people try to get their own campaign message printed on the ballot, and there are certainly problems with that. However, the reality is people who are petitioning their government to change a law or to create a new law do have a right to understand how that change is going to be presented to voters before they proceed with the significant investment in hours for volunteers and money for grassroots operation necessary to qualify that measure. This is another provision that I see as disproportionately impacting smaller grassroots campaigns and particularly volunteer-based signature-gathering operations. The reality is it's probably pretty easy for a well-moneyed campaign with paid signature gatherers to collect 8,000 or 10,000 signatures on several measures so they can get several ballot titles. It's not that easy for a volunteer operation. This could require months of work simply to find out that their measure will be summarized in a way that they don't feel accurately reflects their measure and that they wish they hadn't ever spent the months and months trying to qualify it. I'll stop there and see if the committee has any questions. I'll simply note that we do support the committee's efforts to reduce fraud and would be happy to work with the committee to make sure we can get to a bill that achieves those goals without setting up new obstacles for citizen participation.
I guess to go back to your comments about the registration and to clarify, I think you are clear that that does not apply to volunteers.
So, correct.
And I'm not quite sure why you think it would be such a hardship for people to have to register before gathering signatures. I think some of these things you're raising probably could be addressed in the rulemaking process.
Madam Chair, I agree, and I would simply state that it should be clarified as much as possible up front that any barrier that could create be reduced. Some well-intentioned provisions like this we've seen in other states. As time goes on, decades later, there's a different Secretary of State than the one that proposed the policy, and they get interpreted differently. For example, similar measures that would prohibit writing, altering, or obscuring voter information have been interpreted so strictly in some states that a simple stray mark on the sheet invalidates the entire sheet of signatures, which creates a huge obstacle for volunteer signature gathering. Similarly, if the rules that were promulgated to implement the registration provision set up a process whereby it took a week, and the person, in fact, did have to read hundreds of pages of election law, or the person had to wait for a photo identification to be received, there are a lot of ways that could become significantly problematic, I think, for the process of just having a flexible and nimble campaign happening.
Questions? Vice Chair Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I always love witnesses who talk faster than I do. I really appreciate that. I have a couple questions, if it's okay. One on the registration issue. If it was a same-day registration and if that somehow was put into rules, it had to be a same day, would that alleviate some of the concerns you have?
Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, it certainly would. I think another way that could be alleviated would be a requirement, similar to the record-keeping requirement, that whatever statements regarding understanding of election procedures or employer verification that they believe the person is eligible to be a paid signature gatherer, if registration entitled the employer going through due process and keeping those records on file and perhaps filing periodically with the Secretary of State, that would certainly create no obstacles, and we would support such a provision. It's simply the unknown waiting on the government to allow a person to become a signature gatherer is what causes us some concern.
Very good. And thank you much for one more. On the ballot titled Balcony Shopping issue. Is there a different level that you could see might actually address this? Because I do really understand the point you're making, that no matter what limit we put on this, people with money will be able to buy those signatures. Would 100 signatures or 150 signatures, something that actually would show at least the seriousness of the effort, would that be helpful in any way?
Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, certainly I think a lower number would be perfectly fair. 25 signatures, it's certainly not exactly a mandate of voter approval for a measure to be filed. And I've personally seen measures circulated in a room to get the necessary paperwork going. So certainly a slightly higher number I think would be worth considering. I also think it would be worth broadening the discussion of what we can do about ballot title shopping. In particular, I wonder if there are measures that could be taken to reduce the pressure on that ballot title, perhaps longer ballot titles so that there's more information there and people are less concerned about what information does or does not make it into the ballot title, or other measures that would simply reduce the emphasis on the ballot title being so critical to that campaign and becoming such the focus of pressure from both sides.
Thank you.
Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the question I have is on the paid signature gatherers, there's a restriction or we haven't figured out exactly who's doing this, but the background checks make sure that they're not having identity theft issues, kinds of things. Do you support that? Would you rather it was the people doing it rather than the agency doing it, being responsible for it? How do you see that provision?
Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, we certainly support efforts to make sure that people who have committed any sort of ballot fraud in the past and certainly committed in identity theft would not be allowed to be paid signature gatherers in the state of Oregon. How one implements that, I'm not exactly sure. I'd be concerned that for a small grassroots organization, I know that that doing criminal background checks can require expensive investments and could also become an unnecessary obstacle. So we'd need to explore how to make sure that can happen. But it's certainly a goal that we strongly support.
Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. Jeremiah, I'm sorry I had to step out for a moment. Maybe you answered this question already, but I heard previous testimony talking about having a rolling 2 years or something like that, a little longer period of time for collecting signatures. I wonder if you have any comment on that.
Representative, Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher. We certainly support providing a longer period of time for people to collect signatures. I think part of the pressure for even organizations like ourselves who have a very extensive grassroots network across the state and could rely fully on volunteer signature gatherers is simply that it is true paid signature gathering gets a lot more signatures a lot more quickly. So certainly making it easier for volunteer operations by having a longer period of time during which to collect the signatures would be something we would support. We wouldn't, I don't think, support doing the converse of that, which would be making it harder to qualify a measure quickly. The reality is there are political developments that happen quickly, and sometimes there's citizen response to put something on the ballot quickly, but that's the kind of reform we would support.
Thank you. Maybe just a follow-up comment. Am I to understand that as you see these amendments presently, that am I correct in stating that you see that kind of drives the process towards more well-moneyed professional signature gatherers rather than leaving it where, well, I think where most Oregonians would prefer the process to be is in the grassroots efforts?
Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, overall, I think the bill has some important provisions to reduce fraud, which I think will primarily affect the paid signature gathering operations. I think there are some provisions in the bill currently, specifically the prohibitions on writing or altering any voter information, and the provision requiring 10% of signatures in order to obtain a ballot title, that would unintentionally make it harder for volunteer signature gathering operations and be not that much of an obstacle for a paid operation.
Okay, thank you for clarifying. Thank you. Vice Chair Berger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is almost more of a comment than a question, but I'm really interested in two things in your testimony. One is the your comment about how you could interpret some of these things under some other the strictures that could be put on this by interpretation, and I really share that concern. And the other one is the free speech requirements. Frankly, Jeremiah, I have real problems with making this distinction. Somebody's paid, gathers signatures. Somebody isn't paid, gathers signatures. There's something morally pure about one and not about the other when we're talking about the same activity. So I appreciate you bringing it up.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. And we have Glenn Floyd. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that correctly, but please come forward. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Glenn Floyd with the Oregon Sportsmen's Association. Thank you for hearing me this morning. I just have a couple of things on this particular measure, or bill, excuse me. One's regarding the 10,000 signatures. For a grassroots organization such as ourselves, we're just starting out, and so it's a little bit difficult for us to be able to just come up with 10,000 signatures to try to get things moving. So, like to see something a little different than that. And also, we'd like to see, as far as the, and if I've been listening here, trying to figure out exactly what, things have been changed a little bit maybe, but the actual, ballot or the signatures to be able to have them numbered and have those all indexed, and that seems a little bit difficult for us to be able to do something like that. So we're just trying to make sure that our voice is heard, that we can try to maybe work out something a little different or something that can help out these new grassroots organizations, you know, get moving. You know, we just don't have an unlimited supply of people to make signatures and all. So that's all really I had to say.
Thanks for your comments. Vice Chair Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So Glenn, just 10,000 of your closest friends aren't willing to join with you here.
Madam Chair, represent. Yeah, it's I couldn't say I had that many friends. but yeah, it's, you know, when we're just starting out. We're not even, we just started with this, the previous primary, started moving things along, and that was more of a eye-opening for me. yeah, I got involved with a couple of campaigns, and now I question it. So, no, it was a lot of fun. It got me back in the process. My first campaign moving with things was in 84 with Bill Mashofsky, and got started there when in my sophomore year in high school. And so been out of it for quite a while, and then I guess I called him a buddy, got me involved again, and so I've been doing it. We started the Oregon Sportsmen's Association, so I'm just starting to get involved again and trying to get things moved along to where we can have our voice. And like I said, we're just beginning, and we don't want to make it difficult if we have to use this tool, although we haven't yet.
It's good to have you back in the fray. And my colleague here is a sportsman too. You might want to sign in.
Okay.
Thanks.
Well, we do have a caucus.
All right.
All right. Representative Thatcher.
I guess I was kind of hearing you say that you had some. I don't know. Do you have some suggestions that you
made? Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, 10,000 signatures, a little bit much, you know, a few hundred maybe, somewhere where it's more manageable. If you can have possible Secretary of State's office right now, they're getting really paperless, which I think is great. You know, I'm having to do I'm treasurer for the PAC, so I get to have the joy of doing the new XML formatted style, which I really like because it's all simplified, it's easy, I don't have paperwork showing up in the mail, because you just love getting stuff from the Secretary of State because you never know what you're going to get when you get an envelope. And so, although I have got a phone call or two on occasion, which it's never good. So I think that since the Secretary of State's moving with this, if you could actually print out the ballot measures would be awesome. I mean, to be able, I mean, not ballot measures, excuse me, but the forms, the petitions to get these things moving. That way, you know, they've got already a format for us to use, and it's there for us, and, you know, vice presidential person already invented the internet, so we're going. So.
Okay, thanks very much for your coming. And thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much.
Anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 2082? Ah, come forward. Please identify yourself.
Good morning. My name is Davis Dyer, resident of Kaiser. Sometimes activist collecting signatures, usually almost, well, always volunteer. Just had a few comments that I wanted to address. One, in Section 2, or Part 2, Section 2, where it says no one shall, other than the person signing the petition, shall alter, write, or anything like that. It seems to me that part of the problem has been with the word right, in that as a volunteer and as having collected several hundred signatures in the past, I'm not in the business of altering, but I may, at the person's request, or if something is left blank or dittoed, I will write to comply with current law and in order not to invalidate any person's signature, rather than going back after a day or two to that same person and say, could you please fill this out completely? Understanding that the person did that simply because, well, I saw him there signing it. His wife or spouse or brother or sister, whatever, or whoever had just signed it. Obviously, I knew that he lived there, and so, you know, ditto marks would suffice. But, of course, that doesn't comply with the law. So I might write, but I wouldn't be altering. Perhaps striking that would make some sense. And then, secondly, in Section 5, the templates. In listening to the testimony of Mr. Lindblath, or Lindbeck, excuse me, on Friday, I understood him to say that the template would be, or offering the templates or requiring that the templates come from the Secretary of State was simply seen as a service. But he also said that it's all that has been part of the rule for a long time. My thought is, if the rule has been working fine, or in the context of the rule, this particular segment has been working fine, why not just leave it in the rule rather than putting it into a law like this? And then another aspect, actually in contrary to the previous testimony or testifiers, I'm actually in favor of the 10,000 or the ballot title, because I see this as a separation of the ballot title from the initiative gathering or the signature gathering on the petition. Based on the amendments in here and as testified by the representative from the AG's office, there would be a summary of what the petition is about, an official, non-biased summary, which everyone could read, plus the body of the initiative petition or the proposal itself. And then after 10,000 signatures are gathered, and as part of the total aggregate, then the assuming that with the assumption that the ballot or that the initiative is going to make it to the ballot, then you go after the ballot title. And as long as the initiative is still being circulated for signatures, which the bill provides, There is no stopping for a court case or a court battle, which opponents to some fairly controversial initiatives, of which I have been a part, as well as just viewing in the press or on television. A favorite tactic of opponents is to tie it up in court so as to reduce the amount of time that the person has to gather signatures, thus forcing that organization to rely on paid signature gatherers, which then puts this huge cloud of distrust over that organization and over the motives of that organization, which should not have been there. And so any effort to separate the ballot title, which really makes sense only for voters at the general election, and the process of gathering signatures in order to qualify a particular measure for the ballot makes a whole lot of sense to me. And so I appreciate this opportunity to testify.
Thank you for your comments. Vice Chair Buckley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. Your experience as a signature gatherer, people don't say, what's the title? They say, what's it about? There you go.
Right. And at least, especially more recently, they've been interested in reading the full text of the measure itself, and which, according to this law, I would have to carry with me at all times whenever I'm gathering signatures. And whether I'm paid or not, that would be there.
Very good. Thank you.
I think that's the case right now, however.
It is.
Yes.
It is.
And so they're not so much interested, like, as in the question from Mr. Buckley. And I apologize for not following protocol.
Thank you, Chair.
It's not, the title really doesn't make it a lot of difference, because ballot title, according to my understanding, is summary as well as a brief title to it. And if you have the summary, you don't really need the title.
Okay. Thanks, Representative Thatcher.
I just want to make a comment and thank my constituent for coming out to testifying our committee.
Great. We're glad to have you. Thank you for participating. And seeing no further questions, thanks for your testimony. I will close the public hearing and work session on House Bill 2082.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Seeing nothing further to come before us, the committee is adjourned.